I don't think anybody would argue that the world would be a better place with more kindness. You'll hear from master's teacher, speaker, and author, Alan Questell, who has made it his life's work to create more kindness in the world, on this episode of Making Our World Better.
Welcome to the Making Our World Better podcast, where you will find motivation and encouragement through lively conversations with inspirational people who every day are making our world a better place. Now, here's your host, Jay Clark.
Welcome to the podcast. I am Jay Clark, and I am looking forward to a conversation with Alan Questell, a master teacher who guides students from all around the world to lead better lives. Alan is also a trainer in the Feldenkrais Method, a practice that seeks to improve movement, enhance physical function, and expand self-image. Alan has taught thousands of people in more than 20 countries on 5 continents. He is the author of Creating Creativity, Embodying the Creative Process, and Practice Random Acts of Kindness and Like Yourself More. Alan is constantly discovering how to be kinder to others and towards himself. His book, Practice Intentional Acts of Kindness and Like Yourself More, takes readers through steps to broaden and sharpen their understanding of kindness. It shows ways to embrace kindness in everyday life and provide the means to generate more kindness towards yourself and others. And Lord knows we certainly need more of that in the world today. Alan, I'm thrilled that you're with me today. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, I read that you started your career as an actor in New York, and in searching for cure for back pain from an injury, it really kind of changed the course of your whole life. So I'd love for you to, if you wouldn't mind, kind of take us through your journey from there to how you became a master teacher and now an author and a speaker.
Sure. So as you said, I was an actor, and I actually hurt my back doing sit-ups the wrong way. And then I got better, but a month later, I was wallpapering my acting teacher's bathroom, which was how I made a living. And I hurt my back. He said, go see this Feldenkrais practitioner. And I'd read one of Dr. Feldenkrais's books, and it was interesting, but it really didn't make any sense to me. So I went to a chiropractor, and he made me a little worse. And I thought, well, I'll try this Feldenkrais guy. And this is in New York City. I'm in my New York place like this. And he was moving very slow, and he was barely touching me. And I thought, this is a waste of time and money. And I stood up and I had no pain. And I said, what did you do? And he said, you did it. And I said, no, really, what'd you do? He said, really? I was helping your body do what it's doing. And I thought, oh, it's a secret. And 3 days later, I was driving on a road in New York called the FDR Drive, which is like a pinball machine for cars. And I noticed I wasn't getting angry when people cut me off. And I thought, happened to me.
What's going on?
It was really bizarre. And I went back to this man twice trying to figure it out. I had no pain anymore, but each time I had dramatic differences in how I sensed myself and what I thought about things. And I thought, oh, I bet I could do this part-time and pursue acting. And so I was in the last training that Dr. Feldenkrais taught.
Wow.
And I spent 4 years studying it. And I opened up a practice after that, and I quit everything else I was doing. I was teaching acting at Princeton University, and I had a big contracting business. And in a year and a half, I had a waiting list, and I thought, this is a lot better than acting. That also led me to write my first book on creativity, which originally was about acting in Feldenkrais. And then I thought, let me broaden it and make it about the creative process as well. And it's through the Feldenkrais method, because there's two modalities. One is a hands-on technique called functional integration, and we work with people with all kinds of injuries, neurological problems like stroke, cerebral palsy, and professional athletes, dancers, actors, and anyone who wants to have a change in their self-image or be able to do something, fulfill their intention more accurately. And there's also a classwork called Awareness Through Movement, which is taught to groups and has similar applications. And in those movements, they're done really slow and small. And I was putting together a workshop around self-image. And as I was investigating self-image, I started to think that our self-image is a reflection how much we like ourselves or how much we don't like ourselves.
Yeah.
So if I like myself, I have good self-image. If I don't, not such a great self-image. And then over some time, I started to think this is my job to help people like themselves more. And in the classwork, because the movements are done slow and small, I started offering the people the opportunity to move in a way that you like the way it feels, which is actually kind of like the back door into our self-image. Because most of the time when we want to like ourselves more, it's connected to something external.
Right.
It's a new haircut, a partner, a apartment, a car, all of that, which will fulfill that temporarily for sure. So it's not bad, but it doesn't really generate it from an internal sense. And I found that movement, or I'll also say action in this sense, was one of the more significant ways to grow this feeling of liking ourselves more. And probably one of the best examples of this I felt for myself at the time was I just graduated a group in Australia. And during the graduation, I called their name and they'd come up, I'd give them their certificate and they'd hug me. And so many of them whispered in my ear, I like myself more now. I thought, you know, it's a 4-year training program. And I thought, that's all they walk away from it with, that's
worth
it. Mission
accomplished, yeah, for sure.
And, you know, when I talk about it in every context I teach in. And, you know, I'll ask the question, oh, wait, is there anyone here who doesn't want to like themselves more? Yeah, they laugh like you laugh just now. You know,
of course, right.
That's right. And it's really, I found fundamental to most of the things we do, whether it's taking a class in something, or yoga, or Tai Chi, or learning filmmaking, that the outcome we're looking for, yes, is a level of success in a sense, but that success is often measured by how much better I can feel about myself.
Totally.
And so that was kind of one path that led me there. And then, interestingly enough, one day, and I can never remember what it was, but I did some small act of kindness. And in the next moments, I thought, I like myself a little more for doing that. And, you know, the act of liking ourselves, as I'm describing it, is intrapersonal. It's within myself that I can grow it and develop it.
Sure.
The act of kindness made it interpersonal.
Right.
And as I said before, the idea of movement or action is really fundamental, because if you start looking up kindness, you'll get all kinds of definitions about it, good ones, but none of them tell you how to be kind. The closest you'll get is generosity, but even that's not explained in terms of what does that mean to be generous. So my interest became, in the same way that I was attracted to movement and developing our self-image and liking ourselves more, I thought, what are the actions of kindness that we can generate, approachable ones, easy ones that we can practice every day? So it's not this daunting idea, I have to be kind to everyone.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what led me to our conversation today. So,
well, I love it because it's kind of a very scientific approach to, you know, what does it mean to be kinder? But, you know, after teaching for all these years and, you know, listening to you talk about the movement and action and everything else that comes back to liking yourself more, I mean, so much of this kind of really comes back to a mind-body connection, correct?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny to use that word because it's those words, because people use them a lot. And the funny thing about mind and body is that it implies that they're two separate things. It's really a Cartesian idea that we've lived with for a long time.
True.
And Feldenkrais, he kind of shied away from those words and talked about the self, right? And the self is inclusive of that. So when I think of our self-image, it's not just the mind, the thinking part, right? Our self-image is comprised of our thinking, our feeling on an emotional level, our sensing, how we take in and process information, and our actions, the movements we do in our life. And that those things are always occurring in all of us. And so if we think of it as the self, the image of the self that others may have of me or that I have of myself, that's a little bit of a different take on it,
right,
as opposed to just trying to change my thinking or just trying to get my body in shape, that they're the same thing. They really coexist all the time.
Yeah. Well, and I love it. A friend, you know, who's teaching me guitar years ago told me something that has stuck with me for more than 30 years. And that's, you know, the more you do it, the better you get.
Yeah.
So, you know, I love how you say that kindness is a skill that you can develop. So, you know, I know you talk about this a lot in your book, which I'm super anxious to read, but how do we go about developing the skill of being kinder?
Yeah. So, I mean, there are
that's
many
a big
ways.
Question.
Yeah.
A whole book about, but.
Yeah. Right. And actually I wrote a whole book about it, but I mean, there's many more ways than even what I wrote about.
Mm-hmm.
What I wrote about are everyday things you can do.
Yeah.
Right. So if we talk about, like I mentioned, generosity before. So generosity is an interesting thing to study. You know, when are we too generous? When are we not generous enough? What does it mean to be generous? And so here's a simple task, right? So I say, look, when you go out to dinner, if you tip whatever amount you tip, if you can afford it, if it's within your means, for every $5, give another dollar. So if it's $10, give 12. If it's $20, give 24. And this is kind of interesting. When I was writing the book, I was writing this chapter, and I went out to dinner that night with some friends, a local place, and I picked up the check, and it was $70. I normally would tip like 20%, so I thought, okay, that's about $80. And then I reached in my pocket, and I had a $100 bill, and I thought, I'm going to give the whole thing. And in the next moment, I just clutched. I was like, that's too much. What are you thinking? That's crazy. And I kind of worked it through, and I left the $100. And when I left the restaurant, the waitress actually stopped me and said, you just made my night. And so if you're in any situation, whether it's getting a haircut or an Uber, you'd be surprised that a dollar more makes a difference to people. You resonate with something like that. And it's not a hard thing to do.
Right.
You know? Pretty simple to do.
So tell me that extra $15, that made your day.
It made my day. And, you know, I was fortunate to be in a position where $15 wasn't going to make or break me.
Right.
But even if it's a dollar more, like in fundraising, right? It took me such a long time to understand that actually a dollar donation makes a difference.
Oh, yeah.
It really adds up.
Right.
You know? And I don't realize that the voice we have to influence the world around us, it doesn't have to be a loud voice.
Right.
It can be something small.
That is such a great lesson.
And even to think, okay, I can only give a dollar, but I can feel better about myself by doing that. You know,
yeah.
I was in a store in Santa Fe where I live, and someone had given me a gift certificate for this store. And I found something, but then I had like $15 left on the gift certificate. And I didn't know what to do with it because there was nothing else I wanted. So I'm wandering around the store and I see this young guy and I thought, I said, here's a gift. And I gave him the gift certificate and he was shocked, you know, he was really shocked. And I walked out.
People don't do that. Right.
Well, actually, you know, what's really interesting is since I've written the book and I'm a little surprised that maybe I just didn't observe it before, but I witnessed more and more acts of kindness since then. I see people doing really kind, generous things. But now the tricky part, because what I'm talking about is giving to another, I think that's easier than giving to ourselves.
Agreed.
You know, when I was writing the part of the book on being kinder to ourselves, I got blocked for 5 years.
Wow.
Yeah. And I thought I was kind to myself, but then I realized that there were all these cross motivations for doing it and all these judgments about it and values that it's too much, it's narcissistic, whatever. Until I realized, no, I had to learn more about myself in the process, which is, I'm still learning about it too, for sure.
Well, yeah. And that's, I'm curious that for your take on that is because I think it is so much easier to be kinder to somebody else than it is to be kind to yourself. I mean, because I think we're all naturally just hold ourselves to a different standard than.
Yeah. I mean, that's not true. Of course, there are people who are pretty much mostly kind to themselves.
Right.
we kind of look at them in a different way too and go, well, it'd be nice if you shared that with someone too, you know? And I think that, you know, in many cultures, we're taught to not get too big, you know? It's a funny thing, because like in our culture, with all the Facebook and all the movie stars and everything like that, we're all drawn to that, and it's great. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, it's like, well, where's my place, you know? I mean, like, how do I take care of myself a little bit better?
Yeah.
So how do I move in a way that I like the way it feels?
Right, which again comes back to that mind-body connection. I love it.
That's right.
Was there a tipping point for you when you were thinking about all this that you were like, I have got to write this book?
Yeah. Well, you know, I don't know. But writing a book is really not fun, in my experience. You know, and I'm good at being able to sit down every morning for 3 or 4 hours and just hammer away at it. Sometimes just blah blah blah. Sometimes not making sure I don't check my email and distract myself.
Right.
And it's a lot of work. And of course, one of the big voices I've had in both books is as I'm writing, going, is this worth anything? Who the heck am I to write a book like this? This is like hubris, you know? It's like, but I kept coming back to an inherent sense of value as really feeling like this is my mission to help people right. like themselves more, to create more kindness. And when you ask about the tipping point, I can't say it was an exact moment, but it was a significant moment. And that was around my father. And growing up, I had a 1950s father who he was a nice guy, but we weren't very close, you know. And, you know, it was a okay relationship, I guess. Not, certainly not bad, but nothing more spectacular.
Yeah.
And as he got older, later in his life, first he ran out of money. And my brother and I were fortunate enough to be able to support him. And then he developed dementia. And he was with my stepmother at the time in Florida. And we realized we had to put him in a home. And at that point, though, my stepmother was going back to New York to visit her family for the summer. And I thought, he's going to be all alone. All his friends are leaving for the summer. There's no one there. And I don't know where I got it in my head, but I decided to call him every day. And at the time I lived in California, he was in Florida, so the time differences worked well. So first thing every day I would call him and just talk for 5 minutes. And he always knew who I was. And sometimes he would talk gibberish or put the phone down and keep talking. But I kept at it for like 3 years.
Wow.
And yeah, and I kind of, when he passed, I would kind of wake up in the morning and reach for the phone.
Right.
More, you know. The thing about that, and it's one of the chapters in the book, which I call 5 minutes a day. To give someone your attention for 5 minutes a day. And that was kind of, I guess I could call it the significant or the tipping point.
Yeah.
For realizing that, who am I? Who cares, right? But maybe it helps some people, you know? But, and that, like, you know, after that, like I would say to my dog, okay, I'm going to give you 5 minutes, right? 3 minutes, I was off into the other room, and thank God he didn't have a watch.
Yeah.
You know, he just follow me, but it's not easy.
Right, so, it's not easy.
The exercises that I propose for people in the book, I believe they present a level of challenge, and one where that it's possible to, well, like I suggest in the book, go through it, do the exercises, when you can. If it's too much, skip it. Come back to it later.
Yeah.
You know, and that I talk about the challenge that I think to make real change for ourselves, not always, but often, it's uncomfortable.
Oh, no question.
Outside of my self-image. It's like, I don't feel comfortable, you know.
Yeah.
Or giving someone 5 minutes. But if we find our way, and like what you said before, practice.
Yep.
It's the basis of it all, no matter what it is, you know?
Right.
So.
Well, I think that the concept of, you know, doing something consistently and doing nice things for other people, I think that's pretty easy to grasp. But I'd love to hear about this other concept that you talk about a little bit, which is kindness and listening.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, sometimes people ask me, what's the most fundamental way to be kind? And I would say listening to ourselves, in the sense of what feels right for me. How do I know that? You know, and of course, listening to others, right? And I think that there are many levels around which you can do it on a kind of simple everyday level. I talk about something called intentional chit-chat, you know, and where I got the idea was years before I wrote the book or was even interested in these topics. It was when I was an actor still, when I was living in New York. And my best friend, we were at a bank online, and he was in front of me. He got to the teller, and he just went, "So how's your day going?" And the teller was kind of shocked. She looked up. Someone was talking to her.
Right. She's not used to being seen, right?
Yeah, exactly. And she started. They had like a 2-minute conversation. And I said to my friend afterwards, I said, "Where'd you learn that?" He was from the Bronx. You know, it's like, we don't do that. And he said, "I don't know." And I started doing it. And now I find that, you know, I mean, all of us have the "hi, how are you?" and "have a nice day," all that kind of stuff. And I'm talking about it, just a little shift to pause and really look at someone and say, "How's your day going?" And, you know, it's not going to be a long conversation, but that adds up and we get better at it. And even times when I don't feel like doing it. And, you know, like if I'm on a phone call with the airline or business or something, and I just say, "How's your day going?" People, I mean, I know they have a script when they say, "Fine, thanks, and how's yours?"
Right.
But sometimes I say, "Well, where are you located?" You know, and just to give them a break in the mundaneness of that kind of interaction every day.
Yeah.
And that's a everyday example. I can give you a longer example that was a surprise to me. But I every time I talk about this, I find people resonate with it. So I was on a plane coming back from Europe, and I was on the aisle, and there were two women, two seats across the aisle, and one was an Asian woman, and the other woman was kind of special. When I say special, she must have been in her 50s, but she was talking nonstop about, "Oh my God, look at this. I can see my luggage. I've never seen my luggage. Can you see your luggage? That's my bag right there. And this is the first time."
No.
And this is amazing. And this poor Asian woman's reading. And she says, "Are you Japanese? I've never met a Japanese woman before." And the woman says, "I'm Korean." She goes, "I've never met a Korean woman before." And on and on. And I thought, oh, 8 hours of that.
Oh, I'm going to wear everybody out.
Oh, so at some point I turn around, and the Asian woman is gone, and the other woman's there. And she's like, she sees me and just tries to grab me with her eyes. And I just, a couple hours later, I turn around and the Asian woman is back. And I said, "I just have to ask." I said, what happened? She said, "Well, she was driving me crazy. And so I complained to the flight attendants and they put me in business class." So why are you here now?" She said, "Well, that woman wanted her chance in business class." And I thought, oh, the poor person in business class. And then a couple hours later, I turn around and the special woman is back. And this time she locks into it. And I feel myself just pulling away, retreating. And I caught it. And I went, huh. And I kind of leaned forward and I started talking with her. And I really gave her my attention about, I don't know, 3 or 4 or 5 minutes, not that long. And then at one point I said, I'm going to go back to my book now. She went, okay. And then I thought about it. Imagine the experience being on her end of the world, where she's doing this to everybody and everybody is either trying to avoid her or cut her off or stop her. And I thought, what was the big deal? It really made a difference to her. Now, people then say, but then you were on a plane, so it was a limited situation and time frame. I said, yeah, but I've found that in my everyday life, people are afraid that that person's going to want to be your friend. And I've actually never had that happen. And if that does happen, then we have to be kind to ourselves and be clear about our boundaries and be able to say, yeah, I know you want to have dinner, but just the way we talk, it's really just the right amount for me.
Yeah.
You know, and to say that kindly to someone too.
Right.
But it's someone to listen.
Yeah. And in the meantime, now you validate this woman. She's finally felt seen and heard. Yeah. She feels better.
Yeah.
You feel better. And it was not a Herculean effort on your part, but it had Herculean results, right?
Yeah. But people are doing stuff like that.
You know? Totally.
And everyone knows someone like that.
Yep.
And this is, I always have to be careful when I say that, say this, because the people who I feel most challenged around, whether it's listening to them or working with them in some way or having them as a student, the ones who most challenge me, I've finally come to realize, these are my best teachers.
Yeah.
These are the ones who I get better at navigating a challenging relationship.
Yeah.
Right? You know, so that I had a guy in one of my trainings, and in the end of the second year, he got really challenging. It was like the last 15 minutes of a month-long segment. And he was just, bam, and I just snapped back at him, and I didn't feel very good about it. And then the next segment, I saw him and I go, oh, there's that little, I start grumbling when I saw him. And I went, wait a minute. And so I caught it, and I'll come back to that because that's the really hard part. I caught it, and then I went out of my way to go over and help him as much as I could. And at the beginning, when I would come over, he would almost flinch because he knew he was troubled. You know, he knew the kind of reactions he got out of people. I just kept doing it. By the end, I'd say we had a really good relationship.
That's awesome.
The thing that I was going to say, when I said I caught it, that's really hard.
That is really hard.
I'm trying to figure out how to do that without using the words awareness or attention. But and that's the next book I'd like to write, but I haven't got there yet. You know,
Well, and it just might be me, but if you look back over, you know, the last 8-10 years, it just feels like the tenor, whether it's in the news media or social media or just kind of the way people treat each other, has really kind of veered away from being kind. I think there is a bit of a movement back towards it. But, you know, I'd love to hear if you kind of agree with that. And if so, you know, how do you think that happened? Or what's the genesis behind all that? And I don't mean to, big question.
Yeah.
And don't get political or anything like that. But, you know, I just wonder how we kind of veered into this kind of weird lane that we're in.
Well, one thing is that people, I think since social media, people have more of an opportunity for their own voice. And it's not used in the most positive way.
And it's not very courageous because you can sit behind a keyboard and just kill people.
Well, they think it is. I think they think it's courageous because they're now getting a platform where they can speak. You know, I have a Feldenkrais program for pregnant women and it got reviewed in People magazine. And, the comments that people wrote hurt me when I read them.
I'm sure.
It's like, oh, great, another man telling us what to feel. I was like, whoa, what's this? I'm trying to. And there were a lot like that. And a friend of mine who spends a lot of time on the internet and blogs and stuff, he said, the negative voices are always the loudest.
Yep.
You know, and that's something that, and then the speed of things and how fast things go around. I remember reading something years ago that, and this is a little bit bizarre, but because of the size of the world's population, proportionally, the number of people who are getting killed is actually less than what it was 100 years ago.
Hmm.
So then you read that and you go, like, well, wait a minute, how does that make any sense? Because we read every day about more things. And look, I think the news itself is a bit of a treacherous landscape.
Agreed.
You know, many years ago, I was fortunate. I took some time off and traveled for about 8 months through Asia. And I was reading Time magazine once a week. And I noticed over those months that nothing changed. The only thing that changed that year was Russia broke up. But other than that, it was rehashing. And a good friend of mine, who's a Pulitzer Prize winner, a New York Times journalist, we were talking once about this. And he says, when I go on vacation, I don't read the news.
Hmm.
Nothing changes. It's a rehashing.
Wow.
And that news.
Kind of profound.
It irritates something in us, get upset, and we lose the perspective of distance to go, oh, wait, I'm reading the same thing again. Stop. Don't go into it again.
Yeah.
And, but, you know, I started out by saying that I find that the more I observe, the more kindness I do see. But I think it's a big media thing.
Yeah.
And of course, then you have liking ourselves more. Which,
right.
You know, I mean, that's kind of the ground for Facebook. How many likes does something get that you post?
Or
likes? How many friends do you have? You
know? Right.
And it's like, it's a bizarre measure of ourselves.
You know? I agree.
I'd rather be inclusive. I'm not of the mind to say we need to get rid of that. Don't read the news. No, you need to be informed.
Right.
I think Facebook, I have a page on Facebook called Like Yourself More.
And
every day I post something that says things that make you smile. But I still count the reach and the how many likes. It's like, what am I doing? You know, it's like, what's the measure of this? Something like that. It's a bit daunting with what's going on in the world.
Yeah, no kidding. And,
you know, one thing that maybe it just comes more with age than anything else, that I realize things change. And it feels like when I talk to young people and they're very engaged around what's going on in the world, and of course there's the fear that the way it is will be it.
Yeah.
That it's not going to change. And I've seen it get worse and get better. I've seen our cultures go more to the right, more to the left. And it's going to change again. I don't know what'll happen in the meantime, but it's a hard thing to sit with, to be part of, you know.
Yeah. Well, it means that the work you're doing, I think, is more important than ever. So, you know, what with this kind of weight and what you're trying to put forward, what really does keep you energized and optimistic that we can heal a fractured world?
Yeah, I think I have the really good fortune to teach. And, I teach all over the world, and hundreds of people a year. And watching them feel a little better about themselves is what keeps me going.
Awesome.
You know, I said before, it's my mission, right? And you know, I can qualify that, too, because, you know, when COVID came, and everything that all my work got postponed for 2 years. I was doing stuff on Zoom, and like we're on Zoom, and here's a great opportunity to meet someone to talk about these things. And I think that's a really worthwhile thing. But when I found that all my work was going to Zoom, that became more of a challenge.
Yeah.
You know? And I actually thought, well, if it continues this way, I may have to find something else to do. You know, I just thought there's a place for it. But for me, what I came to realize for myself is that I value the personal interaction, the live personal interaction.
Yeah.
And I value the Zoom interaction as well, to a certain degree.
Right.
And then at some
it's different.
Point,
absolutely.
It's different. You know, I found something really kind of surprising. I had a workshop I was editing about perception, and in it was a lesson about converging and diverging your eyes. So you have a more focused view or a more peripheral view. And what I noticed on Zoom was that I couldn't have a peripheral vision.
That's true.
I can't. I'm looking at little boxes, even on a big screen. Yep. It's one box after another.
Or you're looking at yourself. Yeah.
That's right. And then I noticed that with my converged, focused attention like that, it affected my breathing. Hmm. And then I realized that it made me more impatient.
Mind body, like, right?
Yeah, right. And here, like with you, no, I don't have any of that, right? It's just your face I'm looking right at. It's easy. But if I'm really trying to address a large number of people, it's a skill that I had to learn a lot about to do it. So again, not to eliminate it as the potential for something, but to look at the, what do we gain? What do we lose? And so for me, the personal interaction is more significant. And just like I was saying in that intentional chit chat, listening to someone for a few moments, like I answer all my emails. People write to me and say, I don't know who's going to get this. And I always say, you got me, you know, and I answer them. You know, and I think that that's something that's felt by people, you know, so, yeah.
Well, I love it. So many great lessons. And Alan, I want to respect your time, but I always like to wrap these up with what I call the Fab Four. First one is what is something you will read, listen to, or watch today?
I'm sorry. I'm laughing because I'm teaching in France right now. And Netflix is kind of like one of my go-to things at the end of the day. But I'm actually reading a book. It's a mystery book, but I can't remember the title of it. So I'll probably go read that.
Nice.
And then I'm just going to go have dinner with some friends. Yeah.
Fantastic. So who would you say has been a role model for you in the work that you've been doing and are doing?
Well, there's a lot of people, but... Can I read you a quote?
Love it.
Okay, so this is in my book, and it's a quote from Ram Dass. And I met Ram Dass once. He actually performed the wedding for my brother and his wife.
Wow.
And before I met him, I knew who he was from the book Be Here Now. This is quite 30-some-odd years ago. And there was the Yoga Journal had an interview with him. And I was kind of reading this, going, who's this guy? What's this stuff? And you know what? When I met him, I wanted to hug him. And I had never felt that before. But this quote of his speaks to something that's really personal for me, too. He says, when you go out into the woods, you look at trees. You see all these different trees. And some of them are bent. You sort of understand that it didn't get enough light, so it turned that way. And you don't get all emotional about it. You just allow it. The minute you get near humans, you lose all that. And you're constantly saying, you are to this and I'm to this. The judgment mind comes in. And so I practice turning people into trees, which means appreciating them just the way they are. So, you know, if I talk about kindness, I would say that, like the things I've written about, I think I'm pretty capable of doing all those things. But the next steps for me to be kinder, to like myself more, they're bigger steps. Yep. They're harder. And this describes it. So like if I'm in an airport, I find I'm making up a story about somebody. I don't even know them, good or bad, right? And after this quote, I would look at them and I couldn't figure out how to change it. So I finally came up with a way. I look at them and I just, if I catch it, again, that's that moment, I go, tree, and the story dissolves. And so there's someone like that. The Dalai Lama is someone like that. I think that the person who I watch do an act of kindness, they're the person too. So it's not famous people. It's the everyday people. And I see something, I go, yeah.
That's such a great answer. I love it. Kind of on the flip side of that, are there organizations out there, you're all over the world, are there organizations out there that you really admire the work they're doing or would want to give them a shout out?
Well, you know, I fly a lot, and it's a big footprint, right?
Yep.
All the flying that I do. And I had a friend of mine's son who found this place called Sea Trees that is trying to offset some of the carbon footprint, which I've read a lot of things saying it doesn't really work because the corporations are the ones who need to change. And yet I found that, you know what, donating to them every year, Sea Trees, makes a difference. Also, the animal shelter where I got my dog years ago. You know, I think local places, another place where I live called the Food Depot, which gives meals to people. And yeah. I think anything, I tend to shy away from some of the big, big places to donate money. Like if a friend of mine who's had cancer or something wants me to donate something to this cancer, yeah, sure, I'll give some money. But in terms of really doing it, I think locally is the smartest way to do it.
Love to hear that. As a guy that's run small nonprofits, I'd love to hear that.
Yeah.
Lastly, and probably most importantly, if the people want to, our listeners want to pick up your books, uh-huh. learn more about what you're doing, maybe uh-huh. bring you in as a speaker, what's the best way to find you and to find your books?
Sure. So I have a website for the book called practicing-kindness.com. And the book is available at Amazon as a paperback, and I like to say it's a Kindle instead of a Kindle. And it's also there as an audio book that I read myself. And my contact information isn't there, but I have a number of other websites. And if you just Google my name, feel free to contact me. And if you don't get a response within 2 to 3 days, I didn't get it. And I'm very good with email and stuff and checking my spam folder and stuff. So, and I'm always happy to engage with people and have conversations and see if I can be of any benefit to how you can like yourself more and be a little kinder.
This has been a terrific conversation, Alan. I'm grateful that you take the time from your teaching in France to join me. I can't wait to pick up your book. Thanks for all the lessons and keep up the great work.
Thanks, and thanks so much for having me. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Thanks for listening, and thanks to Alan for his passion and work in making the world a kinder place. This podcast has been brought to you by JC Charity Services. Running a nonprofit is hard. I'd love to bolster your efforts and help you thrive. You can find me at makingourworldbetter.com. To learn more about Alan and his work, visit practicing-kindness.com. You can also find his books on Amazon and follow him on social media. Check the show notes for links. And if you've enjoyed this podcast, we'd be grateful if you'd share it with a friend. Until next time, I hope you're inspired to find a way to make our world better.